Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As President Biden holds more infrastructure talks in the wake of his massive budget request, does his agenda look at risk of stalling? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial writer Mene Ukweberua. On Wednesday, President Biden will have a one-on-one meeting with Senator Shelley Moore Capito, the Republican of West Virginia, who has been leading the GOP side of these seemingly endless talks about an infrastructure proposal. And just to review that, Biden had wanted $2.3 trillion. He's come down to $1.7 trillion. Republicans initially offered about $550 billion, and they've come up to about $1 trillion. But Bill, it looks like we are getting close to a fish or cut bait moment here. And it's not clear to me that there is a whole lot of additional progress being made.
Yeah, you use the words that Secretary Buttigieg used on the prospects of this. Look, in some ways, it's a very natural development. Presidents propose, but Congress disposes. And the sheer size of President Biden's ambitions, the spending, you know, that which is really unprecedented, you know, compared to the size of our economy, means that it was always unlikely that he would get it all the way through as he started intact. I mean, that seldom happens for any president's proposals. They have to go through the White House, but it's go through Congress. But in this case, with you know, no votes to spare in the Senate, and only, I believe, four votes to spare in the House, you're hostage to whatever your own members want. And sometimes they have interests that are different. So I think that's the crunch time. I'm hoping that actually there's enough objection to it that it is severely cut down. I think the question now is not whether it's going to go through intact, but, you know, how much is Joe Biden going to lose in his original proposals when it gets through the congressional meat grinder?
And it's interesting, some of Biden's frustration on this seems to be seeping through. Here's part of what he said on Tuesday, some comments that made headlines. Quote, June should be a month of action on Capitol Hill. I hear all the folks on TV saying, why doesn't Biden get this done? Well, because Biden only has a majority of effectively four votes in the House and a tie in the Senate, with two members of the Senate who vote more with my Republican friends, unquote. And Mene, that was interpreted as a pretty straight barb at two Democrats, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema. But Mene, I wonder if that kind of approach from the president, putting a little bit of pressure on them, is really going to bring them around.
I think it's unlikely that it will. I think that the president probably doesn't realize the position that he's putting the more moderate members of a Democratic Party in the Senate in. Of course, for the first few months, you saw they were pretty easily able to pass the $1.9 trillion stimulus. And that was really a different period, obviously, first, because it was the beginning of a new administration. Members are expected to get on board with the agenda and give them a few key accomplishments to be able to brag about in the midterm elections. But also because the economy was still pretty sluggish at that time. You had a lot of coronavirus restrictions still in place. And people really had the sense that we were still in kind of an emergency period coming out of 2020, and that bold action from Washington was needed. And that's the platform that these moderates in the Democratic Senate caucus were able to run and be elected on. But now the circumstances seem to have changed quite a lot. People see that you are having a more robust recovery. You're getting the lifting of a lot of restrictions, and we already have trillions of dollars of new spending on the books. And so that means if you're someone like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema, it's very difficult to sell to your home states the idea that you're going to continue to uncritically back every single one of these new proposals. And so from Biden's perspective, obviously, he's under a lot of pressure to deliver as soon as possible on each one of these proposals. But I don't think that he can really count on sustaining that support from his more moderate members who face higher stakes than he does.
And it's also true, I think, that if Biden goes this route and tries to put some pressure on Manchin in particular, he gives other Democrats leeway to do the same. And Bill, I mean, I wonder if that ends up, especially with Manchin, pushing him farther away. I mean, he's a Democrat from West Virginia, a red state, a Trump state. And if the pressure gets on him, he might well decide, I can be the guy who goes back home to West Virginia and says, I stood up to these enormous spending plans from the White House of my own party.
Yeah, that's a good question, Kyle. You know, it's also, as Yogi Berra used to say, a little deja vu all over again. Because remember earlier in the year, I believe it was Kamala Harris either cut a commercial or visited West Virginia and made some remarks that were interpreted as kind of anti-Joe Manchin. I don't think he was that pleased. I'm not sure that's the way you get these people. Look, they're all in this position that legislators like to be in. They can all be the deciding vote. So they sort of need to be wooed. It's hard to threaten them. I don't think also that the White House is in the position, for the reasons you somewhat suggest, it's West Virginia, to threaten Joe Manchin, right? We're going to withhold our support and so forth. I think in West Virginia, he's his own man. And I think in any joust over spending and so forth, if Joe Manchin was going to go south on Biden, I suspect the West Virginia electorate would be on his side. So I don't know what he's doing with that. You know, normally it's the opposite. Normally in public, you say, oh, I'm sure my good friend Senator Manchin will come through. He's an important member of the team. And then in private, you ream them out, say, are you going to seriously side with the Republicans on this? And President Biden seems to be doing it the other way. So the potential for backfire, who knows what the potential is for other people. You know, the approach now we're through a half a year of the Biden administration almost, and those elections next year are looming pretty large. And, you know, one of the things Democrats didn't forget about last year is, though Donald Trump did not win and lost, the Republicans picked up a lot of seats. You know, it wasn't so much a rebuke of the Republican Party as it was of Donald Trump. And if that message now, if people get the message, see, we gave Joe Biden a chance. He's not the candidate from the center that he ran as. He is a tool of the progressive wing of his party that just wants to tax and spend. So I think the White House is in a tricky place.
One final thought on this, just to fact check the president a little bit. It's also just not true that that Manchin and Sinema vote with Republicans more than they vote with Democrats. I went this morning and looked up one of these rankings. This one is from ProPublica. So, you know, other rankings might have different numbers. But the ProPublica one says that Senator Sinema has voted against the majority of Senate Democrats six times, or 2.8%. In the 117th Congress. It's a little bit higher for Manchin. He voted against the majority of Senate Democrats 11% of the time, but that still makes him only the 20th among senators for voting against their party. So, Manet, these are both also Democratic senators. It's not like they are, to make up a term, it's not like they're dinos, Democrats in name only.
Oh, right. I mean, that gets to what Bill was saying. You know, when you have these independent-minded senators from moderate states like Sinema and Manchin, it's important to them both to kind of signal to their party that they're able to sort of back kind of the core tenets of the Democratic agenda, but then also keep it in check. That's exactly the message that they're pitching on the campaign trail. And so if you go and look at the actual record on the votes, they're going to be with the Democrats the vast majority of the time. But when it comes to these big ticket items like the infrastructure bill, they're going to have to be able to say that they put pressure on their own party and were able to at least shape it to get into a direction that's more in line with the expectation of their voters rather than just getting on board. And so, it's fairly unreasonable for Biden to expect anything else than these senators exerting quite a lot of pressure and making sure that they're bringing the spending numbers down, that they're getting the provisions that are, you know, specifically appealing to their members, which probably includes more emphasis on core infrastructure projects as opposed to the vast, you know, variety of different spending provisions that the party at large is trying to get stuffed into the bill. And obviously compromise is possible between those two, but there's no way that they're going to kind of simply rubber stamp the agenda. It would be against their political interest to do that.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Meanwhile, analysts are still wrapping their heads around Biden's budget proposal. We talked about this some last week, but the Journal's editorial today takes issue with one specific thing, and I'll read a line here. It says, the White House says growth will sink to 2.2% in 2023 and then average below 1.9% for the next 8 years. That's striking for a couple of reasons. One is that the White House is essentially conceding that all of its unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus really is living for today with little regard for the future, unquote. Bill, what do you make of that argument that there's this tacit admission in the budget that all this spending is essentially going to be kind of a sugar high?
Yeah, I mean, the growth number really alarms me because, you know, it doesn't sound like a lot. I believe we've averaged 3% growth before 2000. The difference between 2 and 3% growth for the American people is tremendous, especially if you're talking about working people and, you know, what it does for their average incomes. It's just a huge difference. This is such an anti-worker kind of proposal. The idea, I mean, again, the idea is that you could spend all this money, borrow a lot of it, and there's just no there's no cost to it, right? And these anemic growth numbers, look at the difference between the growth in per capita income under Obama, the 8 years of Obama with the similarly anemic growth rate, and just a few years of Donald Trump. So at least they're sort of admitting it. It's staggering to me. Again, then again, maybe you can't deny it, but this is I think a terrible message for the US.
Another line that caught my eye was from an analysis of this by a budget wonk at the American Action Forum. And he says that the Biden administration is proposing an average level of taxation, which is 19.3% of GDP, higher than any 10-year period in the history of the modern U.S. tax system. And then on spending, here's the line. Over the next decade, spending would average 24.5% of GDP. There has never been a 10-year period in U.S. history with this level of spending as a share of GDP, even inclusive of World War II, unquote. And so, Manet, I mean, I don't think that Biden expects this budget to pass as is, but the numbers that are being proposed are really striking.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at the levels of taxation that Biden is proposing, you have them trying to go to a 43.4% top rate on the capital gains tax, and also an increase in the corporate tax rate. Originally, the proposal was to go to 28%. There now are signs that they might be willing to compromise on that and bring it down to about 25% compared with 21, which is where it sits now. But either way, the message that they're sending to the American people is that we need to take more money out of the private economy and divert it to our priorities, not only because things like childcare, things like infrastructure spending are important in their own right, but they always make the case that these types of spending create an economic multiplier, which is going to grow the economy even more than it would in the hands of the private sector. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the past 4 years, you can create a side-by-side experiment with the effects that came after the Trump tax cuts, where you saw high growth rates and the lowest unemployment rate in years. And what the Democrats are proposing, by their own analysis, you're going to have long-term growth levels that are far below what we saw in the aftermath of the Republican tax cuts. And so it's just politically baffling that they believe that the American people think are ready to take a firm bet on completely changing direction, despite the good economic results that we had over the past few years.
And that ambition extends beyond just taxing and spending policy. I mean, look at H.R. 1, which is this bill Democrats have written to essentially federalize election administration, write a federal election code for the entire country. And it's a priority. It's H.R. 1. It's labeled H.R. 1 for a reason. And Bill, on Tuesday, Biden said that he's going to fight like heck to pass H.R. 1. He said he had asked Vice President Kamala Harris to lead that push. But here again, it's a bill that Joe Manchin is not on board with.
Yeah, and I think there'll be others that kind of join Joe Manchin on this, in addition to the Republicans. There might be some doubts about it. This is an unprecedented federalizing of the election system, and we see the reaction now in some of the states, Georgia and Texas. And the hyperventilating over the changes that they're trying to make is a direct effort to get H.R. 1 through by suggesting that anyone who opposes it for any reason is really just advocating Jim Crow laws that are discriminatory. So I'm actually heartened by the appointment of Kamala Harris, because it seems to me when something is not going well, and they're looking for the blame, they dump it on her. You know, they've dumped the border on her, and she has been running away from that as fast as she can. I'm not sure she's going to be a lot more persuasive on HR1. That to me is very interesting, that they're putting her out there.
But what's interesting to me to think about is I'm starting to wonder whether Biden might have been better off if Democrats had lost one of those Senate seats in Georgia. Because then he would not be on the hook for all of this stuff. I mean, the problem that he has is he's caught in the middle, and Democrats, a lot of Democrats, the center of gravity in the party has moved to the left over the past 4 years, certainly. And they're saying, we have 50 votes. We can kill the filibuster. We can make free college happen. We can enact this budget essentially as Biden wants it. We can pass H.R. 1. We can do all this stuff. And what's holding us back is some moderates. We don't have the ambition. We don't have the gumption to do what it takes to kill the filibuster. And Manet, I mean, that's a tough place for Biden to be. I mean, maybe I wonder if he had only 49 Senate votes, he might have felt less pressure to put out a budget that is ambitious as the one we saw last week.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, I definitely do think that the left probably is satisfied with the fact that they were able to use reconciliation to get that stimulus bill through, which provided a lot of money to the states that they otherwise would have had a hard time passing. And so there definitely have been real material consequences to the fact that the Republicans were not able to pull out those two Senate seats in Georgia. And there's going to be a lot of sort of suffering in terms of the American fisc for the next few years, just based on that alone. But from a political standpoint, it is clear that sort of Biden himself was elected on a fairly moderate platform. A lot of voters in states like Arizona and Georgia were willing to take a chance on him because they figured that there was a good chance that the Senate would remain in Republican hands. If that had been the case, you probably would have seen the president going with smaller spending numbers on some of these budget bills. You probably would not have had nearly as public of a push. Maybe they would have passed H.R. 1 in the House, but they would have known that it had almost no chance of passing in the Senate. And so Biden would have been able to position himself both as a champion of Democratic spending priorities, but also as a defender of kind of institutional norms in Washington. And he wouldn't have been under much pressure to get rid of the filibuster. But now, sort of with those 50 votes in the Senate, you do have the idea that the only thing preventing the Democrats from sort of locking in their long-term electoral advantage with H.R. 1 is the willingness of Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and some of the other moderate Democrats to get on board with abolishing the filibuster. And Joe Biden is expected to get out there in public and lobby in favor of doing that. And so that definitely does tarnish the image of the Democrats in the eyes of moderate voters.
Yeah, and if he, I mean, if he were to make a bipartisan infrastructure deal for $1 trillion or $1.2 trillion or something like that, Bill, there will always be, since he has 50 votes in the Senate, there will always be Democrats on the left flank who will say we shouldn't have compromised. We could have gotten more. I mean, I agree with Manet here. He campaigned a lot on bipartisanship. And I think the assumption there was that it was going to be a Republican Senate. And then people woke up in early January and surprise, a lot of Democrats started saying we don't really have to compromise anymore. Bill, what do you make of this idea?
Well, the progressive wing certainly doesn't want to compromise. And that's natural to sort of an ideological wing of the party. You know, they have their principles and they want it to go through. I think it makes it very interesting what Bernie's going to do. I mean, they have, on a host of issues, some of these intra-party clashes. For example, on the state and local tax deduction, which the 2017 tax reform took out. And some Democrats are saying they won't vote for other parts of Biden's spending if there's not a provision that restores this. The problem that those people have is that that's not a party-wide position. You know, that affects voters in high tax states like California, Illinois, New York, and New Jersey. The rest of the country, it's not so much of a priority. So there are a lot of these things balancing them. And we'll have to see, like Bernie Sanders, we'll have to see, is he willing to do what you just said? Is he willing, if it comes down to it, to be the vote that prevents a big part of Biden's spending, which he would agree with, Green New Deal, over some principle that he thinks is being given short shrift, or that the amount of money is not enough. You know, it makes every man a potential veto. So I think again, this we should have seen, that this in a tight Congress, the idea that everyone was going to hold still for this mammoth new spending and taxing and redirection of the economy, that it wasn't going to unsettle a few people. You know, and on top of this, there are other issues. You know, Joe Biden's separate issue, but it's trying to get rid of the Hyde Amendment that bans federal funding for abortion. I noticed a bunch of Democrats, 12, I think, in the House, including Connor Lamb, you remember him, the mini Biden from Pennsylvania, are opposing this. So I think the progressive wing and the sheer ambition is setting itself up for a clash, not maybe with the party as a whole, but with a lot of the people in marginal seats from purple areas or areas that had been red before. I think he's going to have to, in the end, surrender a big chunk of his agenda just to get the bulk of his agenda through.
But what's also interesting is that around this debate, particularly the one on infrastructure and COVID relief, around it is changing economic conditions, changing conditions with the virus. I've had my eye on the Centers for Disease Control COVID case tracker. And the moving average of new cases is now lower than at any time since March 2020, which was when the whole pandemic really began in the United States. And the jobs numbers, there's going to be a new set of jobs numbers this Friday coming for the month of April. And Manet, if those look good, I mean, it seems like that would undermine the urgency to push through a whole massive new spending package.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Democrats' message that President Biden came in with kind of put them in an irregular position, because obviously they're hoping to have a strong recovery under President Biden that's going to put wind in the sails of the reigning party going into the midterms next year. But at the same time, they're depending on a kind of sluggish numbers in order to maintain that sense of urgency that allows them to say we need to pass more stimulus and we need to keep enlarged unemployment benefits in place. And so it's tough to say what direction they'll go. It seems as if they're counting on sustained support from within their party to be able to pass all the key elements of their agenda, but their message is weakening. I mean, you saw about a month ago, President Biden came out with sort of an impromptu press conference to address the job slowdown and try to shift blame away from the unemployment bonus that they've continued to sustain and that is supposed to be in place until Labor Day. But it's becoming more and more difficult for them to sell their more moderate members on the idea of getting behind these large spending provisions when Americans can clearly see that there's much less urgency in terms of combating the virus and the sort of economic consequences of the restrictions in place in the economy.
And with any luck, those virus numbers will keep trending downward at a nice rate. Looking at the CDC numbers again, population of the U.S. over 18, 51.7% now fully vaccinated, 62.8% have gotten at least one dose. And more states are following Ohio in putting together these vaccine lotteries. Ohio is giving away 5 weekly drawings for $1 million. It picked its first winner last week. It's going to do another one today. It seems like that has started a trend and also kept the vaccine administration numbers a little higher than they might have been otherwise. And other states are following suit. I love this headline from CNN. West Virginia to give away guns, trucks, and lots of cash as part of its vaccination lottery program. So, Bill, they're giving away lifetime hunting and fishing licenses, custom rifles, custom shotguns. As far as I'm concerned, that's even if that's state money or if it's from federal COVID money, that is money well spent.
Yeah, and maybe the cheap alternative. Look, it looks a lot better than Bill de Blasio, I think, is offering a cheeseburger. Looks like a piker compared to some of the things that are designed to get other people around. To my mind, it's a cost-benefit relationship, and if you could prove this does get people in to get their shots, I don't see why not. And I think, again, this is why we have states to experiment and see which has been the most successful with what practice.
Thank you, Bill and Manet. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.